We're Good Charity, Bad Charity.
And I'm Camilla McGibbon.
I'm Keith Davis.
And I'm David Preston. We're here to do what?
We're here to try and explore the best things we can get out of some charities and exposing some bad practice that maybe we can learn from.
Camilla?
And touch you, because charity touches us all.
Now, we've got a really good guest today. I'm really fantastic. Camilla, you've nerdled this person in.
Helen Rice is a force of nature.
I don't think we've seen anything like this since Enoch Powell, in terms of language that we're allowing to fester.
Helen Rice is the CEO of an organisation called Advising Communities.
I don't think you want a charity to be lean and mean. I don't think I should be mean, to be quite honest with you. I think I should be the opposite of mean.
There are sort of two sides to her charity, in a sense. One is sort of advising individuals, a real sort of first stop call for people in difficulty. And the other one is advising organisations. I think that's probably where we're going to be focusing our conversation, really.
I think Helen is very much on the front line. Yeah. And the job of a CEO, I would suggest, is to take what is happening on the front line, engage with it, because that's where the need is, deal with it at a higher level, because if you've got one person who needs advice on their immigration status or what's happened to their benefits after universal credit, then you've got 10 people and you've probably got 100 people. And a good CEO is probably thinking the whole time, how can I meet that need?
She is also so proactive with advising think tanks, parliamentarians, other organisations. So it's bigger than just supporting. I think my questions are going to be around. It's okay, so what difference is that making?
We like her, we think we like her work, and I think it's fascinating as well that she is very much a woman in control of her organisation, and which brings me on, Camilla, to a subject which you've been doing some research on recently. I gather that you've been looking at the top 10 excuses for keeping women out of the boardroom. And you're going to reveal this in the style of Alan Freeman doing Pig of the Pops.
That dates you. Yeah.
Oh, God. Now, you see, it doesn't date me because I don't know who you're talking about. Yeah. I grew up with American Bandstand. There's a government review of gender representation in UK-listed companies which gives the top 10 excuses for keeping women out of the boardroom.
Let's get straight to number 5.
I don't think women fit comfortably into the board environment.
If that's the feedback some people are giving, it's sad.
Okay, number 4.
There aren't that many women with the right credentials and depth of experience to sit on the board because the issues covered are extremely complex. You see, this is where I want to say what the next thing is, but I'm just so gobsmacked that my mouth is open.
Okay, here we go. Number 3.
Most women don't want the hassle or the pressure of sitting on the board.
Yeah. Oh, dear. It's such a blinkered video. I'm amazed, actually, that they decided to put some of these, unless they're there for the scaremongering bit.
Okay. All the good women have already been snapped up.
Now, this is the city. This is the quote from someone in the city, I think, isn't it? There's a limited supply.
Yes.
Okay. And so here we go. The top answer is,
we have one woman already on the board, so we're done. It's someone else's turn.
I love the fact that they've decided to do this piece of work because I think it needs to be done. But unless you're producing something that's going to be proactively supported and advisory on, okay, so how do we change this? How do we find those great women who actually haven't put their head above the parapet yet?
Yeah, but Keith, that's not the issue. Okay. Sorry.
Go on.
The issue is that we don't want to find those great women because we like the way the club is at the moment. How do you get to, we have one woman on the board already, so we're done, and tell me at the same time they want more women on the board? Either people are blinkered and incredibly short-termist, or they're quite happy, thanks very much.
Yeah.
And the ironic thing in the charity sector as a whole, I think the figures are something like 67% of people working in the charity sector are women, and yet getting to board level, it goes dramatically down to 40-something percent. And then when you get to chief executive level, I think it's around about 32%. It's not even representing the sector as a whole, the statistics, are they, at those sort of levels?
I think there is this attitudinal gap that some people at the top level have. I've just finished doing a piece of work to appoint a new chief operating officer for a company, and one of the board members on that charity said, we don't need a woman on this because they won't be good enough to know the industry. Fortunately, we appointed a woman at the end of the day, and he had to eat humble pie over that because they came in and they developed what they needed to say in a way that they blew us away.
Can I give you an example of where I've been involved in CEO selection? The organisation I was with at the time specifically said we wanted a long list with a lot of women on it, and we got a long list with not very many women on it. So we challenged the executive search person, and he said, well, what happens, he said, is women self-select out.
Yeah.
And I went, okay, can you describe that to me? And he said, well, here you go. He said, here's the job spec. You have to be really good at fishing. You have to speak French. You have to have a budgetary control. And you have to have 10 legs. So the women will go, not very good at French, don't know about fishing. Budgetary control I'm pretty good at, and I've only got 9 legs, so I won't apply. The man will go, 10 legs, duh, I've got 5. That'll do. Speak French. I can learn it. I'm hell at fishing. I'm going for the job.
Right.
So am I supposed to take from that that women are innately modest, or that they're innately honest, or that they're more honest than the men, or the men come from a culture in which it is all right to talk yourself up and the women don't? I do want to hear from men about it, but in another way, I don't.
Fantastic. Let's get our guest in. Really looking forward to meeting her, and let's see what she's got to say. This is Good Charity, Bad Charity. Helen Rice has joined us, and Fuchsia has entered the room, I think it's fairly safe to say.
Yeah.
You're very muted today, Keith.
Yeah, well, I'll get there in the end, won't I?
Camilla is in her trademark striped top, circa Blondie 1984.
Yeah.
Oh,
that's a good thing.
Well, that's a good thing.
It's a good thing. But this is Helen Rice, who has spent 10 years as the chief executive of Advising Communities, formerly Advising London. The charity provides advice that's mostly legal, but also financial, employment, housing, mental health to individuals as well as organisations. She has been described by a trustee from one funding organisation as a force of nature. And one final thing, you're quite scathing about the current situation. You said recently it's never been a harder time to be poor or not speak English in this country. And the working poor in particular have been demonised in a way not seen since Victorian times. Helen Rice, you clearly don't mince your words.
I don't mince my words. I would rather my clients or the people that come and see us were able to articulate those words, but they're the words they're sharing with us.
Yeah, yeah.
So in terms of how people are feeling, I think we're in, you know, a devastating time, a hostile environment, which is, you know, being used around the words of immigration, but a hostile time for anyone who doesn't fit within what we understand or presents life that's hard. And I don't think we really want to face up to that.
Why have we got here? Why have we got to this place at this time?
I think it's been coming for a long time, and I think largely from, you know, government policy isn't helping, but, you know, the media's got a huge amount to play in this. We'd call it the Daily Fail, obviously. They don't fund me, so I don't mind saying that. I wouldn't let them fund me anyway. It's just the nature of the headlines are so explosive. I don't think we've seen anything like this since Enoch Powell, in terms of language that we're allowing to fester.
Your organisation has community at the heart of
it.
How do you define that? How do you define the word community in your head?
For me, the whole word of charity and community go hand in hand. So charity means love to me. Absolutely means love. And when I get emotional and I get upset about something, it's because I care about it and because there's love involved. And community is about people together, showing love for each other, showing neighbourliness, working hand in hand to solve their problems. I grew up in a wonderful community in Somerset, and I've still got friends from school that are still my community, even 30 years on. I still feel that community, even though I don't live there anymore. And I think, you know, we all need to feel a part of something.
That's actually quite a defined research tool, I think, because years ago when I was involved in the community action in and around Thameslink 2000, we had the New Economics Foundation in. And one of the questions was, how many people did you say hello to today?
Yeah.
And if you have high numbers, that defines your health as a community. Mm. Now, my issue with this is I think I'm the only one around this table who's a migrant, who's been a migrant twice. In other words, I have moved. That's all that means. Yeah. The community of migrants isn't really a community, except that it describes all these people that move. Mm. So how do you deal with the migrant community that isn't a community and yet has huge numbers of complex needs?
Obviously, when we're dealing with things, we're dealing with individuals. So on our day-to-day services, we are working and supporting individuals with whatever problem they present with or whatever is going on with their lives. But in terms of working around community, what we find, though, within that, as you rightly said, it's a banner, really, though, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It's a banner of being from a migrant, from being a migrant, whatever that means for you. So it's hard. I think within migrant communities, we find pockets of people that connect because they're from the same place or because they speak the same language or because they're neighbours and they begin to understand each other. But I don't think we do have a migrant community.
No.
It's interesting. You're talking a lot about the threads and the connections between individuals. Mm. First of all, just tell us a little bit about how advising communities works.
We obviously, what we're doing, we're collecting huge amounts of data. So you can imagine the fun we've had with GDPR. and all of that data that we're collecting, we are finding the threads within that often. So we're finding out, you know, the number of people that are having a problem with their universal credit claim. And that we're doing it from a position of, what's the problem you presented with? Are we now seeing 1,000 people that have now got the same problem? And then we will start fighting about that problem. And we're not a campaigning organisation at the moment. Doing policy work and campaign work has never been part of our DNA, but something what I would like to move towards.
What I'm hearing from you now is that you've got all this data that directs where we should be putting money, putting advice, putting whatever.
Yeah.
Are they listening?
I think some of that's my failing or our failing as an organisation probably. I think you go towards the people that listen to you more easily.
Yeah.
And you, so I'm talking, as you heard, about how I feel about certain news outlets presently.
Yep.
But of course, what I should be doing is arguing and tackling them, without a doubt.
Yep.
But the anger's so great that sometimes that's a bit hard to be in that room. And I think that's the challenge for, I think it's challenging for me. I think it's a challenge for organisations like us, that we do more with what we know. I think there are people are listening, but I don't think I'm talking to those that really feel in complete opposition.
Can I swing it slightly at this stage then? Because something else that I was reading from you is about the challenges of getting funding. Interested to know where you get your main funding from, but I'm also interested in what I think I picked up was in the bidding process for tenders at the moment.
Mm.
My experience of working in the charity sector and supporting the chief execs is that seems to be the new wave of tenders is the local authorities or the government are throwing all similar things into the same tender document and then asking for one bidder rather than a lot.
Yeah.
I picked up that's something you feel slightly irritated about.
What can happen is you can get contracts that come out which are absolutely right, which are put together, piles of different things. I can't apply for half of it.
Mm-hmm.
You're forcing me into consortiums in one hand, which you know either won't work, or we're put up against each other in a competitive market. It does not drive me to be in competition with another charity. I do not want to do it. We're in a very difficult space. So if I do not do that, I have very little choice.
But is there an argument which says that, OK, if you put charities in competition with each other for business, they will become leaner and meaner and they will do the job and deliver value for money?
I don't think you want a charity to be lean and mean. I don't think I should be mean, to be quite honest with you. I think I should be the opposite of mean. And everything we do is beyond lean to a point that we're failed businesses, let's be clear. No private business in the world would say, Helen, your business is making so much money, can't wait to take it over. The reality is, for every day that I'm running services, I need 86 live volunteers. What private business would think that that was a good way, a good model? That's how badly we're funded already. So for you to then say, not for you, but for the world to say to us, let's bring that price right down. Let's you argue over whether you're going to bid for this at 62,000 or 64,000 to make sure that we win the contract. Because I've got 4 people staff that I'm going to have to make redundant. And I know that we're reaching the exact client group. And I know we do the best work. And we have that really moment where everyone's looking at each other saying, how low is Helen going to bid for this?
Yeah, I'm with you on this one to a point, you know, because I think local authority and government have loaded the funding against the delivery of a quality service by trying to drive it down. What you're saying to me, I think, is that, you know, you have to make a stand at some stage.
Trust me, I think there's a charity in this universe that wouldn't say we would rather not have government funding. Fortunately, you know, because I want that independence and freedom to do the things we want to do in the right way. However, but, that is Camilla, where we are.
So you're not dwelling, you're not angry, and you also say your biggest lesson from 10 years as a charity CEO is not to panic too much about the money. So you can't panic either. So what do you do?
My state of zen is quite impressive. I think it's holding your nerve. Is definitely true. So when I think things are going particularly, you know, not the right direction, I just keep a deep breath. And I've got a brilliant trustee board who hold my back. I am a true believer in great governance. And if for those that have got a bad board, get a good one.
Yes,
sort it out.
Absolutely.
Stop putting up with it.
So what makes a bad and what makes a good board?
We talk about this endlessly. Yes. And it's so much about individuals, and you're trying not to make it a one-size-fits-all. Yeah.
I think I should be absolutely transparent. I think
you need people to question you and stand up and say, Helen,
clearly,
are you absolutely sure about this? Because I've seen the figures and I see it a bit differently.
No, absolutely. And, you know, and I've cried at a board meeting. And it wasn't because they weren't doing a great job. I had a very long day and I was very tired, but the question was right.
Yeah.
But they're used to me now. I cry at all volunteer functions as well. We're all kind of used to it now. Because I think I'm
tears
just trying to
are
it.
Streaming down her face as
but
we
actually,
speak.
It's actually a release of stress.
Yep.
That's all it is for me. Mm. And that's how I cope and that's how I manage to get over it.
You've started to change the direction slightly, haven't you, of the charity, in that you're now selling your services, which is interesting, and I know of some charities that have tried to go down that route. What are you doing, and how would you advise other charities to look at that as a way of, you know, spreading the risk of income coming in?
We do what I call low bono. So I'm not doing pro bono. There's challenges with that. People can get pro bono. Great. I'm really pleased for you. But I equally think that there's a price point in the market which I can still make enough money to make it worthwhile, but I'm still providing something at £100 an hour, not £250 an hour.
Right.
So I think we're doing a very important service too.
Is that helping to fund the core services that you're providing?
It's starting to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But at what point do you make the decision to say, OK, we're going to have to charge you for this service? Do you make an assessment of those organisations or the individuals?
We still provide 90% of our services for free.
Yeah.
But for those that can afford, and for organisations who would have to pay someone, why don't they pay me? We do advice service, which is really a loss leader for us. So if you're a small charity, it costs £20 to be a member of us, to have advice through email advice.
That's £20 a year.
Okay.
£20 a year gets you as many email consultations.
We might have a chat if it's getting a little bit out of control.
Right, okay.
But we haven't. What I'm saying is we haven't come across it yet. So we'll where we are.
After this, you might, because I think that is a really interesting concept. Because there's a lot of charities out there that would probably love that.
Yeah.
You made a comment, and sorry to quote you again. Okay. Chief exec is holding one's nerve, and you said that before.
Yeah.
Without being foolish.
Yeah.
What do you perceive as being foolish then in that sort of situation? And how have you got out of if you have been foolish?
I would say, for someone who runs a legal charity, and my staff will tell you, I find the law often an ass. And I feel that some things I would be creative about. And that doesn't mean that I would put our reputation to disrepute. It just means that you have to kind of pull the edges of something sometimes to even be here today. Doesn't mean that I don't think I'm acting unlawfully at any point, but I'd say I have to be creative around a problem and how to get around it.
I think what I'm hearing is that you're prepared to sail very close to the wind.
I don't think we'd be here. I don't think charities today would be here if we didn't.
Yeah.
I think those that haven't done that have gone.
This is interesting, isn't it? All of the language you're talking about, the sailing close to the wind, the being creative about problems. This would scare a lot of funders, wouldn't it, normally, Camilla? I mean, looking at you, because your eyes have been getting a little bit wider, I sense, as Helen has been telling us the ways that she interprets her role.
No, I think it's more like I said that Helen would blow you away, and I think she has done. We're sort of in the middle of a whirlwind. No, I can remember Helen coming. Helen and I know each other. I'm a funder. She is a fundee. And we first met not around this tiny table, but around a huge board table and you came in and we asked questions. And at the end of it, we just kind of look at each other and go, well, of course we would give her the money. But how does it feel from your side of the table?
I think we spend, I think probably all day, I'm in a position where I'm being judged, which is quite interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think you just get used to it. I think I'm constantly, so really what I am, I'm a saleswoman for the people we're trying to serve. And the only reason why I'm being maverick, the only reason why I'm stretching the edges of an envelope and trying to work in a space that's so like a tight jacket you can't move around in, is because the people I'm working for deserve better. So if that means that I have to sit on a board table and be judged again and tell my story for the 52 times today, I'm okay with it because that's what I'm here to do and that's my job.
You said just now that there are times when you need to gain your own solace back. What advice would you give chief execs then of charities to say, when you know you're getting to that tipping point, this is what you should do?
I generally walk out the building and I leave for the day. It doesn't mean I'm not thinking or working. It just means that I know when it's time because I'm not responding in the right way. Mm-hmm. I have an incredible network, and I say network in the widest sense of it, of other people that do difficult jobs like me, who totally get it. And I could just say, oh, God, I need to, you know, come on. But I'd say if you think you can do that job, you know, and not have your own coping mechanism and thing you do, and the right people around you to help you do it, you're not going to keep your own mental health, because there's days when, you know, things aren't going the way you wanted them to go.
It's quite interesting because there's an increasing awareness, I think, of mental health amongst charities themselves. Mm. Do you think that there is enough attention paid within charities to the state of the mental health of the people working within those charities and the employees?
No, I'm certainly not doing enough. It's on our present agenda. I think it comes up at every senior management team meeting. When you're hearing people's stories every day and how hard that is and the lives they're leading and how hard that is, I can get a 10 o'clock call on a Friday night from an amazing member of staff saying, I can't leave the building, Helen. I've got twin 18-month-olds and a mother here, and we've been unable to get them temporary accommodation, and I can't leave them. And we've ended up paying for them to go into a hotel for the night, because literally my staff are like, If we don't do something, they're coming home with me because I can't leave this building. That's how much people care about what they do.
Yeah. Do you think we started with the diversity sort of issue? Is there a diversity between how your view of how a female chief exec or female member of staff will open up more and say, "Hey, I'm stressing," or is it now across the board?
I would say I have equitable conversations with men and women about that internally. But I think there's other things around gender which is more interesting. I mean, just to pick up on the thing you started the day with, really. I think it's fine for me to run a community organisation, you know, to do stuff that involves loving people and making them better. That's okay. But you're not going to give me your FTSE 100.
But why not?
Is that you or is that the bigger pressures?
Totally could be me. And I don't even want to do that job, by the way. That's not my point.
Okay.
My point is more, it's also because I'm not a woman who's willing to be something that's not myself. I'm not willing to put a different outfit on and not wear my hot pink.
Yeah, but why not put the hot pink on and go into the room and be yourself and make them change?
Well, this is what is interesting, because I absolutely think that's the right way to go, but you have to get in the room first. It's a failing of our sector that there's very closed doors. I've been involved with benevolent funds, and some of them are doing brilliant stuff, but they're pretty much the only people in this country that hold any money anymore, that old money. Yeah. And trying to help them understand how they could do amazing stuff with that money for people who have never needed it more than they need today. But the people that are getting in the room where that money exists are not the right people.
No.
Okay, so is this a class thing? Is this a snobbery thing?
Yeah.
Is this
yeah.
an old boy network?
Yeah.
All of the above.
And it's white.
Okay.
It's white, yeah. It's massively around colour. Around, for example, for certain funders, I would not talk about benefits. For certain funders, I wouldn't talk about immigration. I talk about homelessness. I talk about poverty. Because I am aware of who the funder is, who's on the board, and I'm aware of, you know, what's going to go down well.
I'm surprised. Someone with your passion that I've seen today, you still restrict yourself at times saying, what I want to do.
Well, I think maybe that does come down to class and education. I was brought up, you know, by a coal mining family who, you know, my grandmother cleaned the houses of the coal miners and my grandfather looked after the pit ponies. So, you know, and also, with, you know, within my family, still, you know, one of the only people with a degree, let alone doing the sort of work I do. I couldn't take 2 years off after university and go and do some NGO work. Mm. Yeah. I had my debts to pay.
Yeah.
I can't even begin to get into the class thing. No, again, it's this business about being a Canadian and in this country, and I've lived here many, many years, the constructs are about not being of the right class, not having the right network, not speaking with the right accent. It's a list, it's a catalogue of negatives. And I always have to kind of pull myself back from being thrown against the wall by this because it is so, so utterly self-defeating.
Yeah.
And I understand that, you know, because my dad was a carpenter. Mm. But my mum told me I could be Prime Minister if I wanted to be.
Oh, my mum did too.
And, you know, that for me is like, I choose not to be, but it gives you that standard of, God, I can.
And the one thing that I'm not going to do a PhD, thank the Lord, but if I did, I'd write about the poverty of aspiration, the poverty of confidence.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. That is the biggest poverty we find. If you can't believe it, position it, then I can't give you anything we tell you, any help we give you today, you will be back tomorrow. And we all know that. And that's the hardest thing about running our organisation, is that we can't change those basic things for people about how they feel about themselves.
Does it make you upset sometimes?
Oh, it's deeply upsetting. I'm generally not allowed near the clients anymore, mainly because I cry with them. We've established I'm a crier. So when I first started, it's horrible because when you know that you can't give the advice yourself, that's really hard because you want to help and things are going crazy and everything's really busy. You want to dig in and you want to help out and do these different things. And it's really hard not to and not have the skills. But I can run reception, love reception work because I get to talk to people all day. You know, I love that. And when things and when things go wrong and my gorgeous staff are saying there's nothing else we can say or do and the person's left in the room crying, then I can go in and have a cup of tea with them and tell them I understand.
Box of tissues.
And that's it.
Works every time.
And that's the only bit. But of course, I cry with them and then they don't want to put me in that. You know, it becomes I'm not necessarily helping. But what I'm saying is just anyone in the world showing someone else some compassion has a value to me. And I think that we all need to do that in every part of our life.
We started on a bit of a pessimistic note about the environment at the moment for people working in charities. We've ended on an incredibly positive, optimistic note. It's incredibly inspiring. You've held it all together emotionally in the room today. We're all wrecked completely. We're going to have to go home and we're going to have to jump on the nearest box of tissues. Helen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
There's something extraordinary, isn't there, when you meet somebody like that? There's a sort of absolute, rigid, single-minded passion about the person running that organisation.
Yeah. I think that passion, that commitment, that enthusiasm comes out so strong with her. And the beauty of it, I think there were so many nuggets within it that, you know, we can take away. This bit about developing the relationships, you know, to make sure that you can deliver on a wider spectrum. I think that is brilliant you know, a belief that, you know, at times you're going to get it wrong.
But that sailing close to the wind comment, which came back again, that being creative with problem solving, that sense that you can't be hidebound by regulations that are towering above you at all times. You've got to find the chink of light that gets you through.
She gets it. I keep bringing this phrase back and I'm trying to define it even for myself. She's got the most creative flicker in her eyes almost. And when you have that sort of ability and speak with conviction that she does, when you're sitting across the table from her, you want to go, here's the money, take it all. And I find it extraordinary that she has so much difficulty at the same time with funding, with the idea that somehow she doesn't belong in certain rooms or certain rooms are closed to her, she says.
Isn't that quite interesting? There's a bit of anger in the mix as well. I mean, she started off very angry about the situation at the moment, very angry about the way that problems are treated with in the national press and things like that. And in the words of Johnny Rotten anger is an energy. You know, you can sort of see it fueling everything,
hugely.
Can't you?
Yeah.
And were you surprised at that? Because I was surprised when she sort of said, well, there's things that stop me going forward.
Yes, because the perception of her from the outside is this woman is unstoppable. This person is unstoppable. Guess what? She's not unstoppable.
She's not. And she recognises that within herself.
Yeah, in herself. Yeah.
But there's something I just want to raise here. You talked about her being in the room with her, being a funder, being wowed by her personality. Now, we know there are examples of people running charities who have done that and have done it to the detriment of the charities that have been running. It's a very high-profile case. We all know which one we're talking about. A charismatic individual as leader. There's also a delicate balance, isn't there, really?
There is. And I think one of the things that has to be said is that when Helen comes into the room with somebody like me and is asking for money, somebody else on my team will have done a lot of work. So it is about having a feeling, making a connection. It isn't about, at that point, about the stats. It is about, do I really feel that this woman can do what she says she can do?
What I picked up from her, I think, was she was saying, actually, it's not about me. You know, it's not necessarily about me, but what I need to do is listen. And what I need to do is have people around me that are prepared to say, hang on, let's think about this, let's talk about it before you just jump into that pool.
But those people around her that she talks about being so influential, they must trust her enough to want to be in that position.
Yeah.
So now you've got this sort of building thing where you get a good CEO who helps build a good board that then is a good sounding board that then helps the organization thrive. But trust, again, comes backwards and forwards. Yeah. And maybe that's part of what it is for me, is that trust, that gut trust.
We're learning so much.
Absolutely.
Every conversation is a learning experience, isn't it? Every day is a learning,
it's
an opportunity.
It's a fascinating creative sector. Just love it.
All right, more to come. That's it for now. We've been Good Charity, Bad Charity. Our producer is Dan Hardoon. We've been recording here in the studios of Whistledown, the boutique studio hire for all budgets. Look us up online, Good Charity, Bad Charity. Keep feeding your feed. Rate and review the podcast. Tell your friends. See you next time. This has been Good Charity, Bad Charity. I'm David Prest.
I'm Keith Davis.
And I'm the wonderful Camilla McGibbon.
We weren't expecting that.
No, we weren't. I like the unexpected.